Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
By the way, Aiden last night gave up like 10 runs. He's 1-10 on the year. It's 1-10.
Did they bother to catch the ball in the outfield last night? I must admit, I was watching the Orioles more closely than them. But it's fun. Like the 3 days a week, they just decide that fly balls are optional. I like that. I'm very down with that.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
So let's stay with the baseball theme. Chris Spira, who's the general manager and the vice president of operations of the D.C. Grays Baseball Club, sent us a big box of that. He writes, today marks the D.C. Grays' 10th year of tribute to the show, kind of. I sent you a box of gear last year, but it came back as unclaimed. Maybe I screwed up, but I prefer to believe it was a set the board back to zero Nigel situation. If not that, then I blame Saliza. I had the boxes from last year for you, Michael, and Nigel in my garage, and I include them here. I've also included a selection of this season's new merchandise and plenty of foam baseballs for your grandsons to chuck around their home. Michael took them. Michael wanted them. As you've generously shared with your audience in the past, the Grays are a 501c3, not-for-profit organization, and are the only D.C.-based team in the Cal Ripken Collegiate Baseball League, which, like the Cape Cod League and others, is a summer wood bat league for college players. We are one of the few teams in major summer collegiate baseball that recruit extensively from historically black colleges and universities. The Grays play their home games at the Washington Nationals Youth Academy at 3675 Eli Place Southeast, and the first home game was a couple of nights ago on the 8th. Today's the 10th. Our website with the roster and game schedule is dcgrays.com. Admission to the home games is free. We're proud to be the official sponsor of the Washington, D.C. RBI Reviving Baseball and Inner Cities program, and to put on other programs to support baseball in underserved communities in the D.C. area. We once again proudly claim our status as the official summer collegiate baseball team of the Tony Kornheiser Show. It's very, very nice, Chris, and we thank you very much, and we always wish the team great luck.
Absolutely.
Wood bat leagues are what we want. We don't want these aluminum bat leagues.
Yes.
I got a lovely painting from our friend George Millay. Look at this, Nigel. It's beautiful.
Oh, look at that.
It's a horse attempting to throw a rider, and it's beautiful. And he writes, Rich Strikes exercise rider Gabe Lagunas earns his paycheck each morning when the strapping chestnut colt tries to dump him before they gallop. The horse's last official timed workout last week at Churchill before shipping to Belmont was 5 furlongs and 59. I watched the video on my video editing software, though, and the time looked like a fraction over 58. That's what we railbirds call a bullet. The horse is ready for Belmont. He'll need some pace ahead of him, but he will close like a freight train. Love this naughty colt. We're going to have Andy Beyer on later. Andy Beyer is great at... We can't paint. George can paint.
Right.
Andy Beyer can't paint.
That really
paint,
is fantastic.
So we're
grateful
for that. I don't have much this morning. I was going to read a bunch of emails. Michael is not with us this morning, and so I can't really talk about the golf that we played yesterday or being fitted for a new driver and all of that.
He called me and said that you were getting a new driver.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'll tell the story when Michael's back because he can amplify it and fill in the holes.
Won't help you with the sand traps, though, will it?
It will not. I can't use a driver out of the sand. So I'll get to the one thing. It's Strasburg. Okay, it's Steven Strasburg. He pitches last night for the first time basically in 2 years.
Yeah.
He pitches. Now, I don't think it's fair to expect much. He's been pitching a little bit in the minor leagues. I honestly don't think you can say, oh, he should come in and he should, you know, give up two hits and one run in five innings and get out and strike out eight. That's not reasonable. It's not reasonable by any standards. So I'll tell you what I saw. Because I made the decision to watch Strasburg rather than the hearings on the January 6th.
Right.
I just wanted to watch Strasburg. And then I watched a little of that, but I watched Strasburg. His line is terrible. It's 4 2/3 innings, 8 hits, 7 earned, but he had 5 strikeouts. Only 83 pitches in that amount of time, which is a lot less than Aiden, for example, or Josiah Gray, for example,
right,
or Eric Fetty, for example, who are sometimes by 5 innings over 100 pitches.
Yes.
You know, his earned run average now in the majors this year is 13.5. So these are silly numbers.
Right.
And he gave up at 1.5 hits in a row in the fifth inning for the Marlins. Jazz Chisholm Jr. singled, then Garrett Cooper doubled and scoring Chisholm. Jesus Aguilar singles, scoring Cooper. Avisail Garcia doubles, scoring Aguilar out at home. I'm sorry. And Jesus Sanchez homers okay? And that brings in a couple. So he, a lot of runs. In the first and the fifth, a lot of runs. What I noticed was this. And Strasburg is very optimistic. He said, said I'm excited to learn from it and get back out there for the next one. I had the great fear that somewhere between the second and third innings, Strasburg would look down at his right elbow right. and then look into the dugout, and the trainer would come out, and he'd be on the DL by the morning.
Yeah.
So I had that fear. But I will say this, and this is not optimistic on my part, but I'll try to explain it. He threw a lot of off-speed stuff, a lot of curves, a lot of change-ups. I thought his fastball, when he threw it, topped out about 90.
Yeah.
That's not fast enough in the major leagues.
No.
Now, I'm certainly willing to believe, the story doesn't allude to this today, I'm certainly willing to believe that he didn't try to gas it. No, he's worried about his arm. He wants to make sure he goes incrementally. He wants to make sure that he's not throwing himself out. That's what I think. Because he's a veteran pitcher, and he knows what he's doing. But, and there's always a but if he doesn't have, as Bruce Springsteen would say, the ability to throw that speed ball by you.
That'll make you look like a fool.
If he doesn't have that anymore, then he's got to be a different pitcher utterly.
Yeah.
We think of Steven Strasburg as a hard thrower. And, you know, routinely, Eric Fetty goes 97. You know, Adon goes 99.
Yeah. Seems like everybody throws in the upper 90s.
90 would be a problem.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to believe that he just didn't try to throw hard, that this is conditioning, that this is let me get back on the mound, let me see what I can do. This is a process, and it's going to take 4 or 5 starts, and I'm very glad that he's optimistic to go back out there again.
Well, you're thrilled that he didn't have forearm tightness or something like
that's
that.
That's right.
And yeah, I think this is, they're looking at this at the long, you know, term, and they say, look, don't blow out your arm.
Yeah.
Trying to throw 105.
I wouldn't do it anyway. Yeah. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's not going to do it.
Yeah. So that's what you hope. I did have one question for you. The way the game began, I don't know if you saw that the first at bat against him, the guy first pitch just laid down a bunt.
Yeah, Chisholm.
I was like, the guy's been out for 2 years. Like, I mean, I know that's
well,
not one of the...
Well, your job is to win the game.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't mind that. You got to have, you know, the pitcher has to field, the catcher has to field, the third baseman has to field, the first baseman has to field, and the second baseman has to cover.
It was unreasonable that I got upset at that.
Plus, that guy's got blue hair. Jazz Chisholm Jr. has blue hair, and he's fast.
He's really fast, yeah.
He's fast. Yeah. He's probably almost as fast, if not as fast, as Trey Turner, who used to be great here, and now is great somewhere else.
Did you see the thing with Trey Turner? With La Russa, he had a 1-2 count on him.
And he intentionally walked him.
Yeah, and then the next, and then it was Muncy.
Boom, Max Muncy. See you around, Tony La Russa.
Yeah, how'd that work out for
well,
you?
Well, the Dodgers are a really good
yes,
team.
They are.
So I'm going to do something I wouldn't normally do. Yesterday, I had some time. I looked through some emails from years ago. I saved them, stupidly, and I looked through them from years ago. So we'll get to them at some point in the show. But we got a lot of nice mail on Lucy Kaplansky's songs, and I thought I would just go through this. From Michael Granberry, who sent us the songs and told us about Lucy. He said, hey guys, thanks so much for playing Lucy Kaplansky's songs. See the email below. Eric Nadel sent it to me. Some guy ordered Leslie Mendelssohn live stream because he heard her on your show. And this is, dear Leslie Mendelssohn, via her manager, who apparently is Kevin. I just bought a ticket for my partner and myself to watch your live stream this Saturday, June 11th. That's tomorrow. I'm going to make this simple for you. The sole reason I'm attending this event is the Tony Kornheiser show. That's it. That's the email from Jamie Edwards in Reed Field, Maine. So, you know, if we can sell some tickets to Leslie Mendelssohn, and we can sell some tickets to Lucy Kaplansky, and we can sell some tickets to Don Stewart, and we can sell some tickets to Dan Byrne, we're happy to do it.
Absolutely.
We're happy to do this. This comes from Rick Franzosa. After all of this time, I may finally have my own David Aldridge moment. You were introducing Wednesday's musician, and I blurted out, wait, I know that Kaplansky. In the mid-90s, I spent significant time working in a partnership with a large, well-known software company at their Troy, Michigan office. My main contact at this company shared my taste in music, food, humor, etc., but especially music. He would burn CDs from obscure artists and pass them along to me. One of those artists was Lucy Kaplansky. One trip up north, I arranged to stay the weekend. We're headed to a little club in Ann Arbor called The Ark, where Lucy Kaplansky was playing. She's not only very bright and extremely talented, but the story she told about the silly songs her dad would sing was very engaging as well. She had us in the palm of her hand. I don't have a connection with her, like the person who sent in the song, but I would request one good reason if she agrees to send in additional music. It's a haunting song about bad decisions, and he encloses the lyrics here. And that's just very nice from Rick.
Very lovely. Thank you, Rick.
Yeah. And we have one to, this is from Lee Goodwin. Thank you for reintroducing me to the music of Lucy Kaplansky. She is or was a bona fide star, although you would not know it from the measly 22,000 listeners she has on Spotify. I saw her many years ago at the Birchmere with Richard Schindel, or Schindel. If you're interested in her music, do yourself a favor and check out the group Cry, 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 named after a Johnny Cash song. It was a trio of Lucy, Richard Schindel, and Dar Williams. Short-lived, but really special while it lasted. And from Lucy herself. I can't thank you enough for playing my songs on your show and for your kind words. I'm just thrilled, and I've already received emails from some of your fans saying how much they liked my music. I'm so grateful for your support. All the best, Lucy. Do this a lot. I talk about this a lot. The reason we play original music is financial.
Yes, it is.
We can't afford to pay the rights fees for Hot Town Summer in the City, which I would normally play. I would normally play The Love and Spoonful and Jackson Browne and Van Morrison and The Beatles, you know, and Bonnie Raitt and Linda Ronstadt. I would play that, but we can't afford it. Even rich people can't afford certain things. So we found out that we could play original music for free. And this is a win-win, because not only is the music wonderful, but we're exposing artists to whoever listens to us, and good things come around on that. And I every once in a while, and I have these talks every once in a while with people, you know, Jeannie or Tori or somebody like that. And we talk about the original music and how good it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not to pat ourselves on the back. I'm just happy it worked out.
Yes.
I'm really happy it worked out. And if it helps people in their careers, that's good. That's good.
Sure.
We still like the funny, stupid music that people send in.
We love that.
You know, we've got room for no talents.
Yeah.
We like that.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's great. But every once in a while, somebody sends in some stuff and you go, that's really good. And you wish those people luck. Because it seems to me that it's hard to make money in music.
Yes.
There are a lot of talented people out there. It's hard to make money in music.
I think that's one of the things I've come to realize is just how many incredible artists there are out there. And if we can give them a platform and make some people aware of them, as you said, it's a win-win. We love the music, and if it helps them out, that's fantastic.
One more. This is from Sam Weitzman from the Columbia Law School and stated August 17th, 2020.
Okay.
I told you, I was going through stuff last night.
There we go. Sure.
I have a confession to make. I am the person responsible for Chris Saliza being credited with the phrase Loomis Chafee School for the Rich. You see, I used to be an occasional editor of Wikipedia, one that sought to add correct information rather than vandalize the site. On March 14th, 2017, I added to Chris's page several pieces of information, including the fact that Chris often humorously refers to his high school by the name of Loomis Chafee School for the Rich. My source for this claim was a tweet by Chris on June 11th, 2016. Where are we now? We're 2022. I did not think again about the matter until I read a profile of Chris in the Columbia Journalism Review, published July 27, 2017, which not only included the Loomis Chafee School for the Rich line, but also cited the exact same tweet by Chris from back in 2016. Clearly, the reporter had simply gone to Chris's Wikipedia page and taken the link I'd posted there without investigating further. Now, with Chris having to clarify the issue in his recent Connecticut Magazine interview, I've decided to step forward and claim responsibility for the slight misattribution, which I've also corrected on Chris's page. It is a far, far better thing than I do than, well, you know. In all seriousness, I miss hearing Chris and the rest of the crew regularly on the show, and I look forward to a post-pandemic time when Chris Saliza can eat it without fear of contamination. I went through these things. I read, I don't know, I looked at about 200. I culled about 8 or 10 that I liked. I don't know how I missed this one.
I don't know either. That's fantastic to know, though.
So Chris, we'll take a break, and when we come back, Andy Beyer will join us with his picks for the Belmont and a little discussion about Rich Strike, the horse that won the Derby and did not run in the Preakness. I am Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is our friend Don Stewart. This is his latest album called Don Stewart Volume 35. You think he's got 35 albums?
He does.
Wow.
Yeah, prolific.
35 albums. The name of the song is titled Guiding Light. I used to watch that. It was a soap opera. I used to watch it. Yes. My wife Marilyn and I listen to you almost every one of your shows. We never get tired of listening to you. She likes to listen to you even though the only thing she really cares about is the Yankees. She's been in a better mood lately because the Yankees are doing well. The Yankees are doing very well. First Amazing. Place team. Thanks for playing my songs. It always means a lot to me. Thanks for the show. It's the best. Again, talent like this should not go unnoticed. Should not go unnoticed. Don Stewart plays in Andy Beyer. And for those of you who think, yeah, you know, I'm pretty good with the horses. I can make some money with the horses. Let's say your name is Bill Schaefer or Johnny Richardson. Do you have speed figures named after you? Because we got Andy Beyer, who has the Beyer speed figures.
Yeah.
That's his credential. Eat it. Okay? Let's understand something. All right, Andy, I would say that the story in the Belmont, because there can't be a Triple Crown because the Kentucky Derby winner, Rich Strike, did not run in the Preakness. I would say that the story in the Belmont is this horse, Rich Strike, and what can he do in his first time out since one of the greatest shocking upsets in the history of horse racing, right?
Right. You know, when he won the Derby, I mean, my first reaction is this is one of the most inexplicable, crazy results I've ever seen in my racing life. Right. But as I looked at it more, and I compared it to the other most crazy race that a horse named Mind That Bird, who was a million to one, won the Derby in 2009. Everybody had dismissed Mind That Bird as just a fluke. He turned out to be a good horse. He almost won a terrific Preakness. And you know, you look at the way Rich Strike ran. We didn't expect it, but he outfinished all the established good stretch runners who were in the Derby. He outfinished Epicenter, the favorite. So it was a legitimate race, and I thought approaching the Belmont that people were going to dismiss him, and I would treat him legitimately, and that he would be a decent bet. Unfortunately, the scenario has changed, and it's a different race from what I think anyone would have envisioned. I mean, the Belmont drew only a field of only eight horses, seven of whom are habitual stretch runners, and there's one horse with speed. A horse named We the People, who people weren't exactly talking about, but he did run one good race at Belmont. He breaks from post position one. He'll be in front,
right,
setting his own pace. Nobody's going to be close to him, and so I think the tactical situation of the race really favors We the People and will work against the stretch running Rich Strike.
I wanted to, ask you, because you follow the lines, you know what's going on. Rich Strike is getting a lot of people betting on him, and I wondered, were you surprised at the respect he was getting? But your research would indicate that he's a real horse.
He is, but this isn't a real classic race.
Okay.
This Belmont is so weak. I mean that this should be the final argument for revamping the Triple Crown, because I mean you've got eight horses, no stars. The Kentucky Derby winner didn't run in the Preakness. The Preakness winner isn't running in the Belmont. The favorite in those first two races is not in the Belmont. Nobody cares really. And the tracks putting on this series really need to reconsider its configuration. There's just the short time between the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness dissuades modern trainers from trying to go back to back, and they need to spread the races out, make the make the later Triple Crown races, like richer to keep the horses in the series. But it's really kind of fallen apart.
This is interesting. We talked about this the last time you were on. For, 50,000 years, it's the Derby, and 2 weeks later, the Preakness, and 3 weeks later, the Belmont. And what we are seeing is sort of what you see in baseball with analytics and pitchers, that they say, no, we're not going to start you every fourth day. We're not going to do that. We're not going to keep you in. We're going to have a pitch count. We're going to try and save you and save your arm. And, Andy, I'm hearing that your position is these things have changed. You cannot compress this into a five-week period, three big races like this. You're going to have to stretch it out maybe throughout the summer, maybe even into the fall. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you want to make it a series, but you don't want to have them so close together that trainers are I mean, Rich Strike was a nothing horse. I mean, why wouldn't you take a chance in to win the Preakness, maybe even win the Triple Crown? You're kind of playing with house money, but no, there's just so many arguments against running horses back. They're not as robust as they used to be. People say the frequent use of Lasix makes horses need more recovery time between races. Whatever it is, they don't want to run back in 2 weeks. And so the Derby owns the first Saturday in May. Maybe you run the Belmont on the 4th of July, and somewhere in the middle is the Preakness. That's the way it's got to be.
Okay.
Because it's obviously failed. Let me add one thing, because many of your listeners aren't going to be paying attention to this on the telecast, but about an hour or so, a couple hours before the Derby, there is a really important race called the Metropolitan Handicap. It's the most prestigious one-mile race in the country, and 1 mile is a distance that breeders view as like the real test of brilliance in a racehorse. And there's a horse named Flightline who is the best horse in the country. He hasn't raced since December, but he's won all three of his races by 11 lengths or more. He got a buyer speed figure of 118 last time, which is by far the best of any horse in the country. I mean, I think this horse, if he keeps on going, is a real superstar. So turn on your Belmont telecast a little early, about 4:43, and watch Flightline. I think we will really have a major star in racing this year.
Okay. This is the Belmont, because you originally said the Derby 2 hours before the Derby, but okay, so this is the Belmont. This is coming up.
Yes, sorry.
There's another race too, Andy, that it seems to me that the Breeders' Cup Classic is the best race of the year, because it's not just confined to three-year-olds. Could they involve that as the sort of culmination of this series, or does that want to stay apart?
No, I think that would be a part. I mean, okay. The three-year-old series, it's kind of has a life on its own, and it's defined for a certain age group, and always has been. I mean, traditionally, later in the season, from September on, is when the three-year-olds step out of their own age group,
mm-hmm.
and meet older horses. And so the Breeders' Cup Classic is the real championship race.
Yes.
It means a lot to anybody who cares about the sport.
American Pharoah won the Triple Crown and then won the Classic, and people started calling it the Grand Slam. Let me just get back to Rich Strike, though. Do you not like him in this race? Would you run away from him?
I picked him second to We the People. I would have gone with him, but listen, when you play the horses, on any kind of regular basis, you understand how powerful lone speed is as a determinant of winners. And when you rarely will see top races where you look at them and say, gosh, there's only one speed horse in here, and everybody else is a closer. And that just gives We the People such an edge.
So he steals it. He just goes out, and they ultimately can't catch him, in your mind.
Right. I mean, even if they try to change their tactics, he's just quicker than the others. And Rich Stryker is almost certainly going to be last in the early going. They can't change his style. So, We the People is kind of certain to be on the lead. Now, a lot of things can happen after that, but he goes into the race with a huge advantage that nobody really could have anticipated 3 weeks ago.
Thanks, Andy. It's great.
Good
it's to great
to
have you. Andy Beyer, bye-bye. Boys and girls. And remember, whatever your last name is, if it's not Beyer, the Speed Figs aren't you. They aren't you. Andy knows more about this than you and than anyone you know. Okay? We'll take a break, and Steve Sands will join us, and we'll try and get into this notion of whether or not the PGA Tour's suspension of all the players who are playing at the moment on the Saudi Tour in London is going to work out. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Hey, Mr. Naismith, you invented quite a game. Chamberlain and Russell, Magic and Kareem, a monumental struggle. A battle amongst the trees, but now it seems it's only layups and threes, layups and threes. Pass it all around, take it to the hole, or else from downtown. The mid-range jumper, no, extinct as a dodo. Jam or pop it, please, layups and threes. Of Kareem's skyhook, much has been uttered, as automatic as Ben Crenshaw's putter. But now they'd say, Kareem, just take it to the rack, or jack it from the circle, that skyhook's kinda whack. Layups and threes, layups and threes, from half court and achievement. If you miss, you're back on defense. 3-point percentage and spacing is the key. Where would we be without layups and threes? Tell me where we'd be without layups and threes.
He's coming down the lane. He misses, but he's going to the line.
He's a genius. Dan Byrne is a genius. I don't know what else I can say. Dan Byrne is a genius. And he opened for The Who.
Yes, he opened.
And he plays in Steve Sands. He's a genius, right? Dan Byrne is a genius.
Did he really open for The Who? I heard you guys say that last week.
Yes, he opened for The Who.
That is incredible. Dan, if you're listening, you are a genius.
This is how we feel. This is how we feel. All right. There's a lot of ordering in this story, and I hope I'm going to get the order right. And I will just start by saying we're going to talk about the Saudi Golf Tour, which is no longer theoretical. It's actual. They're playing it right now, the second round of a three-round deal in London. It's out there. For the first time ever, the PGA Tour really has actual competition that they worry about. And what I think a lot of people thought at the beginning was that the PGA Tour would hope that the majors would do their policing for them and not allow players who played in the Saudi Tour to play in the majors. But the major that's coming up is the United States Open, and the United States Golf Association, which runs it, not the PGA Tour, said all are welcome. If you qualified, all are welcome. Steve, did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me at all because of the timing. It's too late for the U.S. Open and the Open Championship next month at St. Andrews to change the way they go about their business. Now, that might be altered in 2023, but right now it's too late for the USGA. Mike Wann made that announcement last week. It was no surprise, or earlier this week. It was no surprise that he did that because, look, their qualifications, Tony, were already set in place before LIV Golf started. LIV Golf started yesterday. So the U.S. Open is not about to change the way it goes about its business within a five-day period of its biggest week next week at Brookline. But we'll see what happens moving forward after this.
Okay. Well, a lot of my questions are were you surprised questions. Were you surprised by DeChambeau and or Patrick Reed renouncing their membership in the PGA Tour and going to the Saudi Tour?
No, not those two. Those guys have been rumored, talked about, and the people we speak to all the time in the sport at the highest level. I don't think anybody was surprised that Bryson and Patrick took the money.
Were you surprised that Phil Mickelson ultimately said yes and took the money?
No, we talked about this a couple times, Tony, on your show and off your show, text messages. It's not a surprise. Phil was the bellwether to get this thing started in the first place as far as playing goes. Greg Norman is the face of it as the CEO. But as far as competing, the biggest name they had was Phil Mickelson. And I was not surprised, especially what he's gone through the last few months. And as this got closer, Tony, what happened was LIV Golf didn't have the field that it was hoping to get. They have 48 guys. They teed it up yesterday. There's no doubt about that. But they didn't have the big names of who they really, really wanted on the list.
Right.
So the price kept rising. And as that price kept rising, more and more guys said yes. And Phil just kind of waited it out, and he received the most money.
How about Phil wearing the Masters jacket? What a shot, a direct shot at the PGA Tour. I mean, come on.
Yeah. The whole thing is I don't know, whether disingenuous isn't the right word, but the whole thing is such a circus, but it's real, Tony.
I mean, yes.
It happened yesterday. The PGA Tour came out and banned those players like we told you that they would.
We're going to get to that. We're going to get to all that. I mean, yeah.
It's you know, I'm not much for that type of thing, as you say, with the Masters jacket, but yeah, I thought that seemed a little Bush League to me.
Yeah, me too. So we understand Patrick Reed has no impact. Fans don't like him. Other players don't like him. DeChambeau has a certain impact. People like to watch him, but he's not popular with other players. But if Ricky Fowler goes, Steve, Ricky Fowler is popular with fans. He's popular with players. He does more commercials than anybody. If Ricky Fowler goes, what does that mean?
Well, Ricky Fowler's in a very tricky spot. Ricky has a certain standard by which he's lived, and I mean financially, for years. His game has really fallen off. And as his game has fallen off, you start to wonder what's going to happen with the finances. Those sponsors, they demand certain things, Tony. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in a positive way. And when you are Ricky Fowler and you're one of the faces of the sport and you're not competing at a high level anymore, and it's been a while since Ricky Fowler was on the first page of a leaderboard and having a legitimate chance to win on the PGA Tour. On his chest, he has two logos, okay? The two biggest events, the three biggest events so far in golf this season, the Players' Championship begins it, the Masters is the biggest one of them all, which is the second in a row, and then last month, the PGA Championship. The first two, the Players and the Masters, Tony, just think about this. If you're the company who is sponsoring Ricky Fowler, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars here. On one side of his chest, he has a Grant Thornton logo. Grant Thornton is one of the three presenting sponsors of the Players. He was in commercials, and he has it on his chest, and he wasn't in the event. And he was in commercials during the week of the Players, and he wasn't playing in the event. The following month, in April at the Masters, on the other side of his chest, is a Mercedes logo. Everybody knows Mercedes-Benz, the car. He was in commercials, and he is sponsored by the event, sponsored by Mercedes, which is a big sponsor of the Masters, and he didn't play in the Masters. When those sponsors, Tony, come calling and wondering why he's not playing in those events, then Ricky's probably going to lose those sponsorship dollars, and then he's going to be left with just his playing dollars. And right now, he's not making any money on the golf course. So Ricky's in a very tricky spot financially. Not that he's hurting for money, but if he wants to keep his level of pay, he's going to have to go over to LIV Golf unless his game turns around in a big, big hurry.
Okay. So the response from the PGA Tour, and I hasten to add to people that don't understand this, the PGA Tour has no control of any of the majors, not even the PGA. Okay, they don't have that. Their big deal is the FedEx Cup, you know, which nobody can name other than Sands. Three guys have ever won a FedEx Cup. But they've been there. They've been the governing body, basically, of professional golf for a long time, and I think they've done a good job. They have now responded. Jay Monahan has responded by suspending every single one of the guys in the PGA Tour who is playing on the Saudi Tour right now. Will these suspensions have a real effect in your mind, Steve? Will they be honored?
Well, I don't know if they'll be honored because there'll be litigation.
Right.
I think people in the Abbey Lowell stratosphere will be receiving phone calls if sure. they haven't already. And there'll be a tit for tat. And as you and Michael Wilbon have said, not only on PTI, but on your podcast, I think it was yesterday or the day before, the PGA Tour probably isn't going to win those lawsuits, we wouldn't think. But I'm not a lawyer. I've spoken to some lawyers who have explained to me how this whole thing works. Will it have an impact? Sure, it has an impact immediately, because when the PGA Tour returns after the U.S. Open at the Travelers Championship in Hartford, which is only a week from Monday, this coming Monday is U.S. Open week. The following week is in Hartford. And a lot of those guys are on the list to play the Travelers Championship. So, yeah, there'll be an impact, but this is going to get caught up in the courts for quite some time, Tony.
Okay. The thing is out there. The Saudi Tour is out there. You can see it at the moment on YouTube, but it wouldn't surprise me if somebody like Rupert Murdoch flies in and says, you can see it on Fox from now on. It's an odd telecast. It's not what we're used to. We don't go hole to hole. And there's stuff in the left-hand corner about these teams. I don't yet understand it at all. You're in television. I assume you're intrigued by the way they're broadcasting it. And I assume you agree with me that at some point it's going to be out there for the entire American public to consume on television.
Yeah, I agree. I was so excited to watch yesterday. And I don't mean that in a positive way necessarily. I just was so intrigued, so fascinated as to how it was going to be presented, what it was going to look like, the graphics, like you say, on TV that looked different, the set looking different, a shotgun start making it different. There's so many things that are interesting for those of us who are in the business, but also who are just sports fans who are looking to see what it's like. And I got a kick out of some people saying, where is it? It's on YouTube. Well, where was that? And that kind of thing. So for Murdoch or whoever, comes in after this is packaged and after networks see what the product looks like, will they step in, pay the millions and millions of dollars to broadcast it on a more traditional avenue? Perhaps. But let's go back to what you said earlier, Tony, if you don't mind. The PGA Tour is different than the four major championships. Augusta National owns the Masters. The USGA owns the U.S. Open. The PGA of America owns the PGA Championship and the Ryder Cup. And the RNA owns the Open Championship. You talked about the FedEx Cup. The Players is also, the Tour Championship is also under the PGA Tour umbrella. The key to all of this, Tony, here's what we need to pay attention to. The U.S. Open, it was too late for them to change anything for next week. It's also too late for next month's Open Championship because the qualifying process has already begun for the Open. And those two major championships of the four are the Opens. They're open to the world. So if you're going to say you're open, then
you got to let them in
for everybody.
That's right.
So
you got to.
Exactly. So here's the key moving forward. Once we get past July and the major championships in 22 are complete, the PGA Tour and its relationship with those four entities, and also the fifth piece of the puzzle, is the official world golf ranking. We've heard this before. Who's the number one player in the world right now? It's Scottie Scheffler. Dustin Johnson's been number one in the world. All those kinds of things. We've heard that. It's a common vernacular in golf. If the four major championships and the official world golf ranking, which is a separate entity from the PGA Tour and those four majors, if those five entities get on board with the PGA Tour, LIV Golf will be put to bed quickly. If those four major championships and the official World Golf ranking acknowledge LIV Golf and allow the LIV Golf participants to compete in the majors and also earn World Golf ranking points, the PGA Tour has a really, really uphill battle in front of it.
So that leads to the get-out question. In your opinion, as somebody who watches this for a living and knows much more than the rest of us, in your opinion, is golf right now, today, closer to chaos or closer to calm?
Oh, it's closer to chaos right now. Now, that, again, is going to really be predicated. It's going to be predicated on what those four major championships decide and also the World Golf ranking. But more than anything, Tony, Augusta National and the Masters, which is the biggest event in golf.
Yes, it is.
It's the one that means the most in the sport. It's the one that crosses over into the general sports fan as far as viewing, talking about, reading about, listening about. If Augusta National doesn't like this, doesn't think it's good for the game, for whatever reason, doesn't matter what the reason is, if Augusta National says, you know what, if you're part of LIV Golf, you cannot compete in the 2023 Masters, that will change the way things are looked upon. And, you know, kind of like, remember after 9-11, I'm not making this analogous, but whatsoever. Remember after 9-11, the sports world waited for the NFL to decide before every other sport,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
went one route or the other? Well, in this case, in golf, believe me, I'm not making this analogous to 9-11. I'm just using it as an example in a sports sense. The NFL was the leader after the horrific acts of that Tuesday morning in 2001, and then baseball, and then the PGA Tour, and then the other sports followed suit as far as suspending play. In this case,
it's the Masters.
Augusta National, exactly. Yeah. Augusta yeah. National and the Masters is the NFL, all right? If right. the Masters and Augusta National, Fred Ridley, the chairman of Augusta National, Tony, decides, we don't like this, this isn't good for the game, this isn't good for the Masters, we are not going to allow LIV Golf players to participate in the Masters, the other major championships, the PGA Tour, the official World Golf Ranking, everybody will fall in line. And I think that they hold the key to all of this. All the majors do, but especially the Masters. But they're in a tricky spot, Tony. Remember, only 89 or 90 players play in the Masters. If you start banning LIV Golf players and you get your tour, you get your tournament into, say, the 70s, and players are, say there's 70, 72 guys in the Masters. Well, how do you make a cut? How do you do top 60 in ties when you only have 70 or 72 players in the event? It's a very tricky spot for Augusta. But to me, they hold the cards to all of this.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Enjoy the U.S. Open at Brookline. Thank you.
All right, Tony. We'll talk to you next week, bud.
Steve Sands. Terrific. We'll take a break. We will come back with email and jingle. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Thank you.
tremendous. It's Jeremy Vint from Vancouver. It's absolutely tremendous.
Isn't that incredible?
We are all soaked with water. He writes, first, a huge thanks for playing my previous Dr. Hoffoff's mailbag jingle for flugelhorn and synthesizer several times over the last year. Needless to say, I'm thrilled each and every time I hear it. I'm so happy that it seems to elicit such an evocative reaction whenever it's played. It feels like you're underwater. I felt it had been too long since I paid tribute to the good Dr. Hoffoff, now over a year. Please find attached a new mailbag jingle, this time inspired by Johann Sebastian Bach. Fear not, it is public domain, given that he died in 1750 when Mr. Tony was only in grade school. No trumpets or flugelhorns this time, just my trusty Roland Juno 106 programmable polyphonic synthesizer and voice. Unfortunately and evidently, I'm not much of a singer, but something tells me that this just wouldn't have worked with my trumpets, which I use to pay the bills. But besides, how else could I have called lovingly Chris Saliza dope? Please tell Michael we expect rain tonight. It's wonderful. You want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad, please?
Yes, thank you. Bethesda Bagels, we love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com, forward a location in the D.C. area nearest you, then pop on in, and you'll be thrilled.
Before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, bet you're wondering how I knew about your plans to make me blue with some of the guy you knew before between the two of us guys. You know, I loved you more. It took me by surprise, I must say, when I found out yesterday because I heard it through the grapevine. Now, there are a variety of I Heard It Through the Grapevines. And Gladys Knight and the Pips is a wonderful, wonderful song.
Yes, it is.
But Marvin Gaye.
That's the one.
That's number one, two, and three. Marvin Gaye. Thanks to our guests today, Andy Beyer and Steve Sands. Thanks to, as well, to today's sponsors, MeUndies and Simply Safe. Good read by Nigel. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. And as I said, I went through some old emails. I don't know if we've done these before.
In the archives.
This is from September of 2020. Rudy Jeffries. You aren't the only person who buys open pit. I buy it too. My grandmother worked as a grocery store cashier for almost 34 years. She used open pit to the exclusion of all other barbecue sauces. If it was good enough for her, then I suppose it's good enough for me. In the nearly 6 years that have passed since she died, I find myself using it whenever I want to be reminded of her. I'm pleased to know someone else enjoys it too. Open pit. From October 8th, 2020. Hello, not sure who sees these emails. My name is Alex Hughes, a longtime fan and listener, even longer time fan of PTI, literally having watched or listened to the podcast version since inception. I'm 31 now, so it's been a great companion through a lot of formative years. I draw as a hobby, usually portraits. I decided to kill some quarantine time with a portrait of Tony and Mike. I've attached the photo of the drawing here. I don't know if we ever mentioned this. That drawing that he sent us, sent us a different version, is on the PTI set a lot. That's me and Wilbon at age now.
Right.
Not as young men. And it's just great. It's great. Alex Hughes.
Thank you,
if
Alex.
If I thanked you before, I'm thanking you again. From October 14th, 2020, I was rewatching. This is sent from Pat McLaughlin. I was rewatching some old VHS tapes before tossing them. While watching Jim McKay and Peter Jennings, comment on the presentation of nations at the Olympics, they made a comment that Bolivia almost refused to come because of comments made by Washington Post writer Tony Kornheiser. Can you elaborate? In my dark past, I just made fun of Bolivia because I just said they were holding a bake sale in order to get enough money to come here, and I mentioned Butch and Sundance, and they took offense, and rightfully so. It's a long time ago. From Jeff Taylor in Chicago, Illinois. Monday, October 19th, 2020. Late in 1989, when I was in eighth grade, we had a group project to create a newscast in the classroom. This was in the days when an overhead projector and a gigantic 25-inch TV VCR combo precariously balanced on a rusted-out cart with four bad wheels was cutting-edge educational technology. I was assigned to the sports desk. I recorded the previous day's Sports Center. Edited it down to one or two clips, a Dodgers game, if I recall correctly, and brought the tape to school, ready for the oohs and ahs that were sure to follow my ingenious and inventive usage of real highlights in my school broadcast. What I failed to do was write a script or rehearse what I was going to say as occasional description of things that may have happened on the screen behind me. The screen, incidentally, that I could not see while I was narrating the clip, a failure in my planning to rival the lack of script. My primary takeaway from this experience was, man, that was harder than I thought it was going to be. It is for this reason that I am uniquely positioned to tell you that while Boom Goes the Dynamite is the part of that clip that is most instantly recognizable, it is, in fact, passes to the man. That is the funniest part of an entire clip.
Yes,
Boom
it is.
Goes the Dynamite is the only part of what he prepared and delivered as intended, while Passes to the Man is the living embodiment of, man, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. The story is unrelated to our current reality or anything that comes up on the show recently, but being completely out of context and unmoored from reality is part of the show's charm, so I thought I would share.
Love that.
From John T. Mayer, Harvard Law, at Bridgewater State University, 08. This is from October 19, 2020. I graduated from Bridgewater State University, but I told my employer that I graduated from Harvard Law because it's in the same state. Please don't read my name on the air.
Seems like that should be fine.
And this one, I don't know if we ever did this, from September 21st, 2020, from Tyler Thalgott, who wants... I'll just read it. Okay. Maybe we did it. So I don't know.
Strikes a bell with me.
Hello, my name is Tyler Thalgott. I'm 15. So he's 17 now.
Yes.
I'm 15. I recently started a podcast. I know this might not be the best way to contact you about a subject like this, but I was wondering if you could give me any tips about starting my own podcast. I'm a fan of PTI. I listen to it all the time. PTI inspired me to make my own podcast. The podcast quickly runs through the previous day's MLB games and gives insights on moves to make for your fantasy baseball team. The idea is to do all of this in 15 minutes or less for people with short commutes. It's called the Fastball. It has minimal popularity, but my audience is growing. I started getting serious with it and bought a real podcasting microphone. Just adding a mic does not make a podcast flawless or even good at all. That being said, I would still greatly appreciate some tips to grow the podcast and make it higher quality. First of all, I will likely not go back. First of all, the podcast I thought had a good concept. But one problem is if people miss a day or two, they will likely not go back and listen to the past episodes as they probably already know the outcomes of the games. How should I go about creating content in addition to the 15 minutes or less episodes I've been doing that will encourage people to go back and listen to episodes that they missed? Secondly, do you have any tips to smooth out the podcast? Right now, my episodes are not terrible, but they're somewhat choppy. They have long pauses as I read the script. I might stumble on a word or two and my computer will freeze. Do you have any tips in that sense? I guess how to make it flow better. Thirdly, I wanted to know what to do as the season finishes. I somewhat set myself up for failure by doing a podcast about the baseball season and a shortened baseball season. That means I will have minimal content to record on and eventually run out. You somewhat went through this during the sports drought of COVID, and I was wondering how you were able to create content when there were no sports to make content on. Finally, this would be sort of my dream job in the future, to have your job.
Oh, there we go.
I love talking about sports and sharing my opinion on sports. I would love in the future to have an opportunity like you to share my words with others through the media about the things, sports, that I love. The podcast was a step in the right direction, but how could I take this further? How could this propel me in the right direction? And what do I have to do after high school to pursue a career in sports broadcasting and journalism? I know the odds of getting a response are very low, but if I do get one, that would mean the world to me. Thank you. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions. Yeah, there's
that's
a lot
really
in there.
A lot.
Yeah.
If you're still doing this, Tyler Thalgott, after 2 years, then you're probably on your way.
Sure.
And you'd love to have my job. Well, you got to start by being a columnist at the Washington Post.
For about 25 years, yeah.
You know, it's, you know, I'm rooting for this kid.
Yeah.
Most of the words are spelled correctly. I don't know if we did this before or not.
I do not remember.
I don't know.
I think I would remember that detail, that sort of detailed questioning. You know, but I would just say to the kid, you know, just keep doing it. You know,
I would say to him that he understands his circumstance when he says, well, if all I do is baseball, when the baseball season ends, the hell in God's name do I do next? Well, yes, you have to sort of figure that out.
Yeah.
And Tyler, I didn't face what you faced because I know how to talk for hours. I just talk for hours. It's what I do. I'm so old. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, including Tyler Thalgott, do wear what?
Now, if there's anything I can do for you, well, I certainly hope you'll die soon.
Oh,
Mr. Naismith, you invented quite a game. Chamberlain and Russell, Magic and Kareem, a monumental struggle, a battle amongst the trees. But now it seems it's only layups and threes, layups and threes. Pass it all around, take it to the hole, or else from downtown. The mid-range jumper, no-no, extinct as a dodo. Jam or pop it, please, layups and threes. Of Kareem Skyhook, much has been uttered, as automatic as Ben Crenshaw's putter. But now they'd say, Kareem, just take it to the rack, or jack it from the circle, that Skyhook's kinda whack. Layups and threes, layups and threes, from half court and achievement. If you miss, you're back on defense. 3-point percentage and spacing is the key. Where would we be without layups and threes? Tell me where we'd be without layups and threes.
He's coming down the